Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehr. Egypt's constitutional crisis shows no signs of letting up. Protests continued through the weekend, with both supporters of President Mohamed Morsi and critics of his expanded powers taking to the streets. A draft constitution was hastily ratified on Friday by the Islamist-dominated assembly, but Egypt's judges say they will refuse to oversee a referendum on that constitution later this month. Some see this as the most serious threat to Egypt's internal security since the revolution. Freelance journalist Noelle King has been reporting on the ongoing protest, and she joins us from Cairo on Skype. Welcome back to WNYC, Noelle.
Thanks so much, Anna.
And listeners, if you have family in Egypt, if you're an Egyptian-American, have been following these protests from New York or the New York area, we want to hear what you're hearing from home. Call in 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. So, Noelle, a little background. Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi seized expanded powers late last month, in which he said what he says are temporary measures to ensure that remnants of Mubarak's government are contained. He declared that his actions were above judicial review, and it's led to this standoff with Egypt's judges. Now, protests on all sides are out in the streets. The Muslim Brotherhood and Islamists are aligned with Morsi. But on the other side, the protests are bringing together some unexpected coalitions. Who's concerned about Morsi's powers at this point?
Well, you know, the opposition to Morsi is a very broad group of people, and it includes secular Egyptians, left-leaning Egyptians, liberal Egyptians, Christian Egyptians, some more moderate Muslims who have never really found themselves at home with the Muslim Brotherhood. And interestingly enough, this weekend what we saw in Tahrir Square was a mix of all of those groups, plus some of the folks who didn't fare so badly under Hosni Mubarak and were never really behind the Egyptian revolution in the first place. Now, those two groups are in a way right now forming some sort of uneasy alliance, but it remains to be seen how much they're going to stick together in the weeks ahead. As you might imagine, the sort of revolutionary Egypt, or the Egypt that supported the revolution, remains very, very suspicious of people who didn't get behind the uprising in the first place. And on the other hand, as you say, we saw enormous protests this weekend outside of Cairo University from the supporters of Mohamed Morsi. These are members of his Muslim Brotherhood and the even more conservative Salafi parties, who for the moment have aligned themselves with him. Interestingly enough, Anna, both of these protests, both the opposition and the Morsi supporters, were supposed to meet in Tahrir Square. At the very last minute, the Muslim Brotherhood pulled back and said, you know what, we're going to have our protest in a different neighborhood. And the assumption was, the conventional wisdom is, they did that because they were afraid if the two groups met in the streets, we might be looking at fistfights, clashes, or even blood being spilled, which I think really points to a sort of hardening between these two positions, which many people at this point find very, very worrying.
Huh. So describe for me in terms of numbers. You said their supporters and the opposition to Morsi were in the streets over the weekend. What kind of numbers did you see in Cairo?
Well, you know, these are very, very hard questions to answer because some of these demonstrations are so very large that the idea of trying to get to the bottom of numbers is nearly impossible. But on both sides, what we did see reported was that hundreds of thousands of people turned out. Now, you look at Cairo, which is a city of 25 million people, and hundreds of thousands seems a little bit like a drop in the bucket. But needless to say, these are the biggest demonstrations that we've seen since the Egyptian revolution. It's really worth noting is that traditionally, Cairo and Alexandria, which are the two larger cities, are the seat of these sort of protests. They're the places where people go out in the streets. What we've seen since this very controversial decree by Mohamed Morsi on Thanksgiving night is that other parts of the country are starting to go up. Some of the smaller areas in the Nile Delta, some of the smaller towns down south. And that is something that everybody who's surveying the landscape in Egypt right now is very, very nervous about, because traditionally, those rural areas are strongholds of support for the Muslim Brotherhood in a lot of ways, and they remain pretty calm. So what we're looking at now is sort of countrywide agitation, if you will.
Huh. Interesting. Egyptian Americans, if you're from Egypt, living in the New York area, following this news from here, call in and tell us what you're hearing. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Noelle, you referred earlier to sort of an ambivalence among some of the pro-democracy activists in Tahrir Square about being aligned now with people who maybe weren't so much for the revolution to begin with. How have you gotten a sense of that ambivalence? How are they talking about it?
Well, you know, for the most part, some of the louder voices are saying we will never, never align ourselves with what they call the Fulu or the remnants of the Mubarak regime. On the other hand, I think there's a fair bit of pragmatism among particularly some of the new political parties that are forming, including this so-called National Salvation Front, which is a grouping of liberal and leftist political parties, but has been joined by some political heavyweights in Egypt, including Mohamed El Baradei, who's the former head of the IAEA, and Amr Moussa, who's the former head of the Arab League, who also ran for president in Egypt. Now, what this group is trying to do is just get the numbers out. Following the Egyptian revolution, they were a fractious group. The liberal opposition really fell apart. There was squabbling, there was infighting. They formed not one political party or two political parties, but so many that at times it almost seemed like a joke. And many Egyptians said it was a joke. You can't have 24 opposition parties if you want to present a united political front. So I think there's a fair bit of pragmatism right now that says, let's just get the numbers out in Tahrir Square and out for some of these protests, and later on we'll worry about who's supporting what.
And as President Morsi defends his position and his expanded powers, he says it's necessary to make sure that Mubarak's allies don't gain traction in this new government. Is that convincing any of the opposition protesters at all? What do they make of that? Just see this as power grab, or see this as a necessary stage to create an independent government?
Well, Morsi's critics say that he's grabbing the kind of powers that even Hosni Mubarak would have only dreamed of. And they are not convinced by this argument that after a certain... once we've got a new constitution in Egypt, which is what he said, he's going to put those powers aside and he will return to just being the president. There will be no more far-reaching authority. Now, one of the more interesting things, and maybe even the sadder things about this decree by Morsi, is that he's really poisoned the well, even among some people who didn't agree with him politically, but were prepared to support him. And I'll tell you anecdotally, I met last week with a pro-democracy activist, an older man who's sort of a 30-year veteran of the fight to sort of resist Hosni Mubarak. Now, this was a man who had a really interesting story of, in the mid-1990s, as a democracy activist, even though he didn't agree with the Muslim Brotherhood politically or religiously or socially, he found himself defending them in a lot of cases because Hosni Mubarak enjoyed prosecuting them on trumped-up charges because he viewed the Brotherhood as a threat. So anyway, what this man told me was that, I don't agree with Morsi, but when he ascended to the presidency, I really wanted to give him a chance. I wanted him to be a democratic leader, and I hoped that he would move this country in the right direction. Unfortunately, what this man told me is, you know, his decree on Thanksgiving night changed all of that, and I'm going to be returning to Tahrir Square for the first time since February of 2011 when Mubarak stepped down.
Huh. Ahmed in Woodside, you've been following this from here. What are you making of what's happening in Egypt right now?
Yes, I just want to make a couple of points. First of all, the question of the numbers of the supporters of Morsi and the non-supporters in Tahrir Square was not really answered. But there is official numbers. From official numbers, they're saying totally the supporters, huge numbers, high, more than 1.5 million. So that's one point. Second point is, what's going on now is really very healthy in democratic and freedom. And this is the price for any country go transition to pay. It's noisy, it's uncomfortable, but we have to take it. And also, if this not really the opposition coming to Tahrir Square rejecting Morsi decree, wouldn't be healthy, because we need opposition, we need everybody is to have the voice for the direction of the country. The third point I want to make is Lara group in Tahrir Square, really they have a loud voice and they have accessibility to the TV, the media, and so on. But they're not really representing the majority of grassroots in Egyptian people. When you they go to elections, the result is totally different. So now we're not really afraid of that kind of loud voice, but the end of the day is the election or the referendum for the constitution coming up in 2 weeks. And then because people tired from 2 years, nothing accomplished, and they need to move on. And we never forget about the transition period, and even in America here, 7 years to write the constitution and to bring stability.
Well, let me ask you, Ahmed, it sounds like you have some skepticism about the kind of large voice that the protesters in Tahrir Square have. What do you think about President Morsi's decree? Do you feel comfortable with that? Feel like it's part of the transition? Or
I'm not supported 100%, but under the circumstances of people tired to move on, to accomplish something for the revolution, to have a constitution and to have the elections, yes, that's something, the price you have to make. There is billions of dollars every month. It's in the street to hire people to protest. And there is evidence of that. And there is American embassy in Cairo. They have a record for when the movie coming anti Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and the protest was in the front of Cairo embassy, mm-hmm. American embassy. So the protester was really civilized, was really a good protest, that violence at all. They raised their voice against across the street from the embassy, and embassy, and the group was paid to go to make violence and to go over the fence of the embassy to make Egyptian look ugly and violence and so on.
Well, Ahmed, thanks so much for your call. Sean in Crawford, New Jersey, you're an Egyptian-American watching this from here. What do you think about what's going on?
Well, the people that I speak to that are also engaged Egyptian-Americans, they weren't really convinced, I think, from the beginning that, you know, the election was fair, and that's such a big thing that had to be addressed, but was never really looked at very carefully. And, of course, a lot of people just finally blew it over and just realized that, you know, they have to deal with what they have, and that's just the end of it. And what I feel confident about are that there are some positives in the future. You know, I think that a lot of Egyptian Americans are still very hopeful. A lot of my American friends, my closest friends, actually, feel that, you know, this is just a big negative. But I don't feel that way. I'm optimistic, and I think that even though I was not a supporter of Morsi at all, that there is a great deal of hope, because the Egyptian people really are looking for something that they intend to get and that they're not going to relent. And for that reason, I think that this is a good thing, and people need to speak their voice, and I think what's happening is very healthy. And I think the results of this will be good, because I think the conquer and divide scenario in the Middle East generally is really all conquer and divide. And I don't think the Egyptians want to fall under that category right now politically in the world. And let's just see what happens.
All right, Sean, thanks so much for your call. Noel, what of the draft constitution that passed through the assembly late last week? What are human rights groups saying about it? What is it, you know, how is it being assessed?
That's a really great question. And there are parts of this constitution which I think human rights advocates find really, really heartening, Anna. There are bits that say you cannot be detained for an indefinite period of time. You cannot be tortured when you are in the custody of the police. So there are certain rights and freedoms that Egyptians under Hosni Mubarak probably couldn't have even dreamed of that are included in this constitution. On the other hand, some of these rights and freedoms are very vaguely defined, and there seem to be other articles that contradict them. Now, let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. Article number 45 in the new Egyptian constitution says that freedom of expression is protected. Well, how could that be a bad thing? That's terrific, right? But there are two other articles which say very explicitly, the first says, you cannot insult any human being. And the second says, you cannot insult any prophet. Now, the question is, when we're talking about how you're going to have these constitutional articles interpreted in the future, if you get to a situation where you've got a critic of the government, just as an example, a critic of the government who doesn't like what President Morsi or any other president going forward has to say or do, and is raising his or her voice and saying, I disagree with this, does that person's right to speak his or her mind fall under the doctrine of freedom of expression, or does it fall under the doctrine of you can't insult any human being? So some of these things are very deeply concerning to rights advocates, and I'll mention one other because it has created quite a stir here in Egypt, and that is the way the Constitution treats women and women's rights. There is no declaration, there's no part of the Constitution which explicitly says that Egyptian men and Egyptian women are equal. In fact, when Egyptian women are mentioned in this new Constitution, the parts that they're mentioned have to do with the family and the home and balancing the family and the home with work life. So there's one article in particular which says the state will help a woman balance her work life with her home life. That makes a lot of women...
I'm sure a lot of American women would like that in the Constitution.
Does it mean something like, well, the government is then going to provide free child care? Or does it mean a woman is going to be urged not to work if she has children at home? It's all going to come to it's all going to come down to how these things are interpreted by the court system. And because that has been so, so vague in the past, it still makes a lot of people very nervous, despite some of these, you know, very good provisions.
And of course, if it's up to judicial review and President Morsi has decreed that he is above judicial review, how do his actions fit into this draft constitution?
Exactly.
Huh. All right. And so what of if the judges are now saying they are going to boycott this referendum later this month to ratify the constitution, does that mean the vote can't take place?
No, what it means is that the vote runs the risk of not seeming legitimate in the eyes of the Egyptian people. And here's what normally happens, or has been happening for several years in Egypt. Whenever there is a big election, you have judges posted in the polling places to observe and to make sure that nothing undemocratic or untoward happens. The judges got pretty good reviews during Egypt's last set of democratic elections for the presidency and for the parliament. People felt as if their presence there was really preventing anything negative from happening. If this referendum goes ahead and the judges say we're not going to observe it, they run the risk, the whole country runs the risk of then having a constitution, or possibly, if the vote is no, not having a constitution, but without any sense of legitimacy. And I think, you know, this gets to some of the points that your callers earlier were making, which I think are very important. There is a sense in Egypt that people want to remain optimistic, but because the post-revolution period has been so turbulent, and there's been so much political back and forth, there's, you know, continuing battles in the streets on sort of every few months. The country's economy is in a state of disarray. It's made it very difficult for people to believe that the best is going to happen.
Ahsan in Queens, you're following this. What are you hearing from family in Egypt?
Well, friends and family in Alexandria actually have been talking about that there's definitely a groundswell of dissension against Morsi's actions. Now, the feeling is they want to support him, and they want him to succeed so Egypt can be successful. But the fact that he took these powers is troubling to them. And I want to agree with the first caller that said that they just want the referendum to be over with, so Egypt can move forward.
And as far as being disappointed in President Morsi's actions and his decree, who do they see as the alternative?
They don't. Now this is actually interesting. The people that they see, like El Berdi, they view, and Amr Musa, they view them as taking advantage of this turmoil to further their own political powers. They don't view them as, an opposition or a potential candidate for presidency or opposition power. They view them as individuals who are taking advantage of this turmoil in order to benefit their own political parties or their own groups.
Noel, do you get a sense that kind of cynicism is widespread, people looking at the different players and how they're fitting into this, and just this general sense of the optimism from the revolution further sort of deflating?
Yeah, I think, I'm sorry, I forget his name, but your previous caller makes a really, really good point that, Amr Musa and Mohamed El Baradei are guys that post-revolution really made an effort initially, or people thought they would make an effort to sort of get their hands on power in Egypt. They didn't approve of the political rise of the Muslim Brotherhood, even though the Brotherhood were democratically elected. These guys were never really happy about that. They have seized on this opportunity in order to further their own political goals, which include, they say, moving toward a more democratic Egypt. But there is certainly cynicism and skepticism, and that would extend to just about every Egyptian politician, not just the big guys, the little parties too. And I think, again, that is a result of some of this chaos that we've seen post-revolution, where it's really hard to tell who's after what and who's telling the truth.
And that also goes for Egyptian judges, right? There's been tension between the Muslim Brotherhood and the judges since Morsi's election in June. So perhaps, you know, they are concerned about his decree that he's above judicial review, but also they've been, you know, rivals, right?
Yeah, there's a narrative in Egypt which says that a lot of the judges who are currently on Supreme Courts and High Courts were appointed under Hosni Mubarak, and that means that they must be loyal to Hosni Mubarak, which means they don't want any other group, including the Muslim Brotherhood, in power, and they are going to be deliberately unfriendly to this group. The courts have taken moves like dissolving the democratically elected parliament, which was dominated by the Brotherhood and other Islamist parties, which seem to suggest that there might be some truth in that. Although defenders of the court say, look, these guys were appointed under Mubarak, but Mubarak was not the guy who put them into power. Effectively, judges in Egypt nominate themselves, and then the president's seal of approval is really a formality. So it's very, very difficult. The judges mostly speak in their decisions. They don't really speak, many of them, I should say, don't really speak to the press. And so it's difficult to tell what exactly is going through their heads. And when they make these controversial rulings, like disbanding a democratically elected parliament, it does open them up to charges that they're exhibiting a great deal bias.
Hossein in Brooklyn, you agree with President Morsi's decision, his decree?
Yeah, I agree with President Morsi's decision.
And why?
Why? Because I don't see any other solution. I look to the people against him. I look to Barari, I look to Musa, I look to Sabahi, I look to all of them. Their program is not clear. They don't have any solution. They don't have any other solution. I look to them. They only just refuse for the sake of refuse. They don't have any plan. They don't have any solution. They're just looking for themselves. They're not looking for the benefits of Egypt. They're looking for their benefits. They don't have any other plan, actually. This is why I'm saying that what this Morsi is saying now, what Morsi is doing now, is the right thing, at least at this time, at this moment. And we need to give him a chance. Now, what we're looking for is a democracy. He's saying in December 15, you can go to vote, and then you can have the democracy, real democracy. You have a parliament, you have the president, and you have the judge, and you have all this reorganization which is controlling Egypt. Everybody is working in his field. So what we're looking for is the democracy. This is the democracy.
Hossein, thanks so much for your call. Noel, there's a march on the presidential palace planned for tomorrow. You mentioned some of the weekend protests were actually held in different places. The opposition to Morsi and his supporters were in different places out of concern of, you know, containing the threat of violence. Any sense that's the people are worried about that with this march tomorrow?
You know, I think people are always worried about that, not because Egyptian protests are geared toward violence or that anybody wants violence, but because there's an uncomfortable situation which tends to happen in Egypt, in places like Tahrir Square and in front of the Ministry of Defense, which happened last year. When you've got a group of people, and some of them are not interested only in sort of peacefully marching, but in pushing the authorities a little bit, the authorities fire back and don't always use live bullets. Sometimes they use rubber bullets, and sometimes they, you know, use tear gas. And then what we're looking at is a much larger conflagration, and the streets just ignite. And that's something that I think, on the whole, the majority of Egyptians overwhelmingly really, really want to avoid. But it still does happen, and I think it's an area of real concern. Is how will we get to a point in this country, people ask me all the time, where we can have a protest in the street and it won't turn ugly? We can simply go out, express our point of view, go back to our homes, and there won't be anybody left back in the streets battling with the police as night falls, which is something that we see pretty frequently.
And finally, Noah, I want to ask you how Egyptians are seeing this in terms of greater Middle East politics. President Morsi was widely credited for brokering the ceasefire in Gaza. We had the vote in the UN last week to designate Palestine as a non-member observer state. And then after that vote, of course, Israel announced plans to expand settlements. Are Egyptians talking about these stories along with this constitutional crisis?
Well, you know, it's a great question, because one of the guarantees of every man who ran for president in Egypt was that he was going to restore Egypt to its former place of regional importance, that he was going to be a power broker in the region, not just within the country. Egyptians were glued to the outbreak of hostilities between Israel and Hamas and other groups in the Gaza Strip. And I think a lot of people were very relieved when that turned out, when there was at least some sort of truce brokered by, it's credited to Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi. On the other hand, this country is so convulsed by its own political turmoil, its own economic turmoil, that I think in a lot of ways what Egyptians want is for Egyptian leaders to focus on what's going on in Egypt and to fix the problems here before they take a much bigger role or play a much bigger role in the region at large.
All right, journalist Noel King joining us via Skype from Cairo. Thanks so much for calling in.
Thanks, Anna.
Coming up, we're going to look at copper wires and telecom infrastructure after Sandy. I'm Anna Sale in for Brian Lehrer.